That was more than he asked, because he could not have asked for that and been Ants, using himself so with a word. And then he died. He did not know he was dead. I would lie by him in the dark, hearing the dark land talking of God's love and his beauty and his sin, hearing the dark voicelessness in which the words are the deeds and the other words that are not deeds, that are just the gaps in people's lacks, coming down like the cries of the geese out of the wild darkness in the old terrible nights, fumbling at the deeds like orphans to whom are pointed out in a crowd two faces and told, "That is your father, your mother." I believed that I had found it. I believed that the reason was the duty to the alive, to the terrible blood, the red, bitter flood boiling through the land. I would think of sin as I would think of the clothes we both wore in the world's face, of the circumspection necessary because he was he and I was I. The sin the more utter and terrible, since he was the instrument ordained by God who created the sin to sanctify that sin he had created. While I waited for him in the woods, waiting for him before he saw me, I would think of him as dressed in sin. I would think of him as thinking of me as dressed also in sin. He the more beautiful, since the garment which he had exchanged for sin was sanctified. I would think of the sin as garments which we would remove in order to shape and coerce the terrible blood to the forlorn echo of the dead word high in the air. Then I would lay with Ants again. I did not lie to him. I just refused. Just as I refused my breast to Cash and Darl after their time was up, hearing the dark land talking the voiceless speech. I hid nothing. I tried to deceive no one. I would not have cared. I merely took the precautions that he thought necessary for his sake, not for my safety, but just as I wore clothes in the world's face. And I would think then, when Cora talked to me, of how the high dead words in time seemed to lose even the significance of their dead sound. Then it was over. Over in the sense that he was gone, and I knew that, see him again though I would never again see him coming swift and secret to me in the woods, dressed in sin like a gallant garment already blowing aside with the speed of his secret coming. But for me, it was not over. I mean, over in the sense of beginning and ending, because to me there was no beginning nor ending to anything then. I even held Ants refraining still, not that I was holding him recessional, but as though nothing else had ever been. My children were of me alone, of the wild blood boiling along the earth, of me and of all that lived, of none and of all. Then I found that I had Jewel. When I waked to remember to discover it, he was 2 months gone. My father said that the reason for living is getting ready to stay dead. I knew at last what he meant, and that he could not have known what he meant himself, because a man cannot know anything about cleaning up the house afterward. And so I have cleaned my house. With Jewel, I lay by the lamp holding up my own head, watching him cap and suture it before he breathed. The wild blood boiled away, and the sound of it ceased. Then there was only the milk, warm and calm, and I lying calm in the slow silence, getting ready to clean my house. I gave Aunt's Dewey Dell to negative Jewel. Then I gave him Vardaman to replace the child I had robbed him of. And now he has 3 children that are his and not mine. and then I could get ready to die. One day I was talking to Cora. She prayed for me because she believed I was blind to sin, wanting me to kneel and pray too. Because people to whom sin is just a matter of words, to them salvation is just words too.
Whitfield. When they told me she was dying, all that night I wrestled with Satan, and I emerged victorious. I woke to the enormity of my sin. I saw the true light at last, and I fell on my knees and confessed to God and asked his guidance and received it. "Rise," he said, "repair to that home in which you have put a living lie, among those people with whom you have outraged my word. Confess your sin aloud. It is for them, for that deceived husband, to forgive you, not I." So I went. I heard that Tull's Bridge was gone. I said, "Thanks, O Lord, O mighty ruler of all. For by those dangers and difficulties which I should have to surmount, I saw that he had not abandoned me, and that my reception again into his holy peace and love would be the sweeter for it. Just let me not perish before I have begged the forgiveness of the man whom I betrayed," I prayed. "Let me not be too late. Let not the tale of mine and her transgression come from her lips instead of mine." She had sworn then that she would never tell it, but eternity is a fearsome thing to face. Have I not wrestled thigh to thigh with Satan myself? Let me not have also the sin of her broken vow upon my soul. Let not the waters of thy mighty wrath encompass me until I have cleansed my soul in the presence of them whom I injured. It was his hand that bore me safely above the flood, that fended from me the dangers of the waters. My horse was frightened, and my own heart failed me as the logs and the uprooted trees bore down upon my littleness. But not my soul. Time after time I saw them averted at destruction's final instant, and I lifted my voice above the noise of the flood. "Praise to thee, O mighty Lord and King! By this token shall I cleanse my soul and gain again into the fold of thy undying love." I knew then that forgiveness was mine, the flood, the danger behind. And as I rode on across the firm earth again, and the scene of my Gethsemane grew closer and closer, I framed the words which I should use. I would enter the house. I would stop her before she had spoken. I would say to her husband, "Anse, I have sinned. Do with me as you will." It was already as though it were done. My soul felt freer, quieter than it had in years. Already I seemed to dwell and abide in peace again as I rode on. To either side I saw his hand. In my heart I could hear his voice, "Courage, I am with thee." Then I reached Tull's house. His youngest girl came out and called to me as I was passing. She told me that she was already dead. "I have sinned, O Lord. Thou knowest the extent of my remorse and the will of my spirit. But he is merciful. He will accept the will for the deed. Who knew that when I framed the words of my confession, it was to Anse I spoke them, even though he was not there? It was he, in his infinite wisdom, that restrained the tale from her dying lips as she lay surrounded by those who loved and trusted her. Mine the travail by water, which I sustained by the strength of his hand. Praise to thee in thy bounteous and omnipotent love. O, praise! I entered the house of bereavement, the lowly dwelling where another erring mortal lay while her soul faced the awful and irrevocable judgment. Peace to her ashes. God's grace upon this house, I said.
Darl. On the horse he rode up to Armstead's and came back on the horse, leading Armstead's team. We hitched up and laid Cash on top of Addy. When we laid him down, he vomited again, but he got his head over the wagon bed in time.
He'd taken a lick in the stomach, too, Vernon said.
The horse may have kicked him in the stomach, too, I said. Did he kick you in the stomach, Cash? He tried to say something. Dewey Dell wiped his mouth again.
What's he say?
Vernon said.
What is it, Cash? Dewey Dell said.
She leaned down.
His tools, she said.
Vernon got them and put them into the wagon. Dewey Dell lifted Cash's head so he could see. We drove on, Dewey Dell and I sitting beside Cash to steady him, and he riding on ahead on the horse. Vernon stood watching us for a while. Then he turned and went back toward the bridge. He walked gingerly, beginning to flap the wet sleeves of his shirt, as though he had just got wet. He was sitting the horse before the gate. Armstead was waiting at the gate. We stopped, and he got down, and we lifted Cash down and carried him into the house, where Mrs. Armstead had the bed ready. We left her and Dewey Dell undressing him. We followed Pa out to the wagon. He went back and got into the wagon and drove on, we following on foot into the lot. The wetting had helped, because Armstead said,
"You're welcome to the house. You can put it there."
He followed, leading the horse, and stood beside the wagon, the reins in his hand.
"I thank you," Pa said. "We'll use in the shed yonder. I know it's a imposition on you." "You're welcome to the house," Armstead said.
He had that wooden look on his face again, that bold, surly, high-colored, rigid look, like his face and eyes were two colors of wood, the wrong one pale and the wrong one dark. His shirt was beginning to dry, but it still clung close upon him when he moved.
"She would appreciate it," Pa said.
We took the team out and rolled the wagon back under the shed. One side of the shed was open.
"It won't rain under," Armstead said, "but if you'd rather."
Back of the barn was some rusted sheets of tin roofing. We took two of them and propped them against the open side.
"You're welcome to the house," Armstead said. "I thank you," Pa said. "I'd take it right kind if you'd give them a little snack."
"Sure," Armstead said. "Lulu'll have supper ready soon as she gets Cash comfortable."
He had gone back to the horse, and he was taking the saddle off, his damp shirt lapping flat to him when he moved. Pa wouldn't come in the house.
"Come in and eat," Armstead said. "It's nigh ready." "I wouldn't crave nothing," Pa said. "I thank you." "You come in and dry and eat," Armstead said. "It'll be all right here."
"It's for her," Pa said. "It's for her sake I'm taking the food. I got no team, no nothing. But she will be grateful to e'er a one of you."
"Show," Armstead said. "You folks come in and dry."
But after Armstead gave Pa a drink, he felt better. And when we went in to see about Cash, he hadn't come in with us. When I looked back, he was leading the horse into the barn. He was already talking about getting another team, and by supper time, he had good as bought it. He is down there in the barn, sliding fluidly past the gaudy, lunging swirl, into the stall with it. He climbs onto the manger and drags the hay down, and leaves the stall and seeks and finds the curry comb. Then he returns and slips quickly past the single crashing thump and up against the horse, where it cannot overreach. He applies the curry comb, holding himself within the horse's striking radius with the agility of an acrobat, cursing the horse in a whisper of obscene caress. Its head flashes back, tooth-cropped. Its eyes roll in the dusk, like marbles on a gaudy velvet cloth, as he strikes it upon the face with the back of the curry comb.
Armstead. But time I give him another sup of whiskey, and supper was about ready. He had done already bought a team from somebody, on a credit. Picking and choosing they were by then, saying how he didn't like this span and wouldn't put his money in nothing so-and-so owned, not even a hen coop. You might try Snopes, I said. He's got 3-4 span. Maybe one of them would suit you. Then he begun to mumble his mouth, looking at me like it was me that owned the only span of mules in the county and wouldn't sell them to him, when I knew that like as not it would be my team that would ever get them out of the lot at all. Only I don't know what they would do with them, if they had a team. Little John had told me that the levee through Haley Bottom had done gone for 2 miles and that the only way to get to Jefferson would be to go around by Motson. But that was Anse's business. He's a close man to trade with, he says, mumbling his mouth. But when I give him another sup after supper, he cheered up some. He was aiming to go back to the barn and set up with her. Maybe he thought that if he just stayed down there, ready to take out, Santa Claus would maybe bring him a span of mules. But I reckon I can talk him around, he says. A man'll always help a fellow in a tight, if he's got a drop of Christian blood in him. Of course, you're welcome to the use of mine, I said, me knowing how much he believed that was the reason. I thank you, he said. She'll want to go in on. And him knowing how much I believe that was the reason. After supper, Jewel rode over to the bend to get Peabody. I heard he was to be there today at Varner's. Jewel come back about midnight. Peabody had gone down below Inverness somewhere, but Uncle Billy come back with him, with a satchel of horse physic. Like he says, a man ain't so different from a horse or a mule, come long, come short, except a mule or a horse has got a little more sense. What you been into now, boy? He says, looking at Cash. Get me a mattress and a chair and a glass of whiskey, he says. He made Cash drink the whiskey. Then he run Ants out of the room. Lucky it was the same leg he broke last summer, Ant says, mournful, mumbling and blinking. That's something. We folded the mattress across Cash's legs and set the chair on the mattress, and me and Jewel sat on the chair and the gal held the lamp, and Uncle Billy taken a chew of tobacco and went to work. Cash fought pretty hard for a while, until he fainted. Then he laid still, with big balls of sweat standing on his face like they had started to roll down and then stopped to wait for him. When he waked up, Uncle Billy had done packed up and left. He kept on trying to say something until the gal leaned down and wiped his mouth. It's his tools, she said. I brought them in, Darl said. I got them. He tried to talk again. She leaned down. He wants to see them, she said. So Darl brought them in where he could see them. They shoved them under the side of the bed where he could reach his hand and touch them when he felt better. Next morning, Ants taken that horse and rode over to the bend to see Snopes. Him and Jewel stood in the lot talking a while. Then Ants got on the horse and rode off. I reckon that was the first time Jewel ever let anybody ride that horse, and until Ants come back, he hung around in that swole-up way, watching the road like he was half a mind to take out after ants and get the horse back. Along toward 9 o'clock, it begun to get hot. That was when I see the first buzzard. Because of the wetting, I reckon. Anyway, it wasn't until well into the day that I see them. Lucky the breeze was setting away from the house, so it wasn't until well into the morning. But soon as I see them, it was like I could smell it in the field a mile away from just watching them, and them circling and circling for everybody in the county to see what was in my barn. I was still a good half a mile from the house when I heard that boy yelling. I thought maybe he might have fell into the well or something, so I whipped up and come into the lot on the lope. There must have been a dozen of them setting along the ridgepole of the barn, and that boy was chasing another one around the lot like it was a turkey, and it just lifting enough to dodge him and go flopping back to the roof of the shed again where he had found it setting on the coffin. It had got hot then, right, and the breeze had dropped or changed or something, so I went and found Jewel, but Lula come out. "You got to do something," she said. "It's an outrage." "That's what I aim to do," I said. "It's an outrage," she said. "He should be lauded for treating her so." "He's getting her into the ground the best he can," I said. So I found Jewel and asked him if he didn't want to take one of the mules and go over to the bend and see about ants. He didn't say nothing. He just looked at me with his jaws going bone white and them bone white eyes of his'n. Then he went and begun to call Darl. "What you fixin' to do?" I said. He didn't answer. Darl come out. "Come on," Jewel said. "What you aim to do?" Darl said. "Going to move the wagon," Jules said over his shoulder. "Don't be a fool," I said. "I never meant nothing. You couldn't help it." And Darl hung back, too, but nothing wouldn't suit Jewel. "Shut your goddamn mouth," he says. "It's got to be somewhere," Darl said. "We'll take out soon as Pa gets back." "You won't help me?" Jewel says, them white eyes of his'n kind of blaring and his face shaking like he had an auger. "No," Darl said, "I won't. Wait till Pa gets back." So I stood in the door and watched him push and haul at that wagon. It was on a downhill, and once I thought he was fixing to beat out the back end of the shed. Then the dinner bell rung. I called him, but he didn't look around. "Come on to dinner," I said. "Tell that boy." But he didn't answer, so I went on to dinner. The gal went down to get that boy, but she come back without him. About half through dinner, we heard him yelling again, running that buzzard out. "It's an outrage," Lula said. "A outrage." "He's doing the best he can," I said. "A fella don't trade with Snopes in 30 minutes. They'll sit in the shade all afternoon to dicker." "Do?" she says. "Do? He's done too much already." And I reckon he had. Trouble is, his quitting was just about to start out doing. He couldn't buy no team from nobody, let alone Snopes, withouten he had something to mortgage he didn't know would mortgage yet. And so when I went back to the field, I looked at my mules and same as told them goodbye for a spell. And when I come back that evening and the sun shining all day on that shed, I wasn't so sure I would regret it. He come riding up just as I went out to the porch, where they all was.
He looked kind of funny. Kind of more hangdog than common. And kind of proud, too. Like he had done something he thought was cute but wasn't so sure now how other folks would take it.
I got a team, he said.
You bought a team from Snopes? I said.
I reckon Snopes ain't the only man in this country that can drive a trade, he said.
Sure, I said.
He was looking at Jewel with that funny look, but Jewel had done got down from the porch and was going toward the horse to see what Ants had done to it, I reckon.
Jewel, Ant says.
Jewel looked back.
Come here, Ant says.
Jewel come back a little and stopped again.
What you want? He said.
So you got a team from Snopes, I said. He'll send them over tonight, I reckon.
You want an early start tomorrow, long as you'll have to go by Motson.
Then he quit looking like he had been for a while. He got that badgered look like he used to have, mumbling his mouth.
I do the best I can, he said. For God, if there were e'er man in the living world suffer the trials and floutings I have suffered.
A fella that just beats Snopes in a trade ought to feel pretty good, I said.
What did you give him, Ance?
He didn't look at me. I give a chattel mortgage on my cultivator and cedar, he said.
But they ain't worth $40. How far do you aim to get with a $40 team?
They were all watching him now, quiet and steady. Jewel was stopped halfway back, waiting to go on to the horse.
I give other things, Ant said. He begun to mumble his mouth again, standing there like he was waiting for somebody to hit him and him with his mind already made up not to do nothing about it.
What other things? Dahl said.
Hell, I said. You take my team. You can bring them back. I'll get along some way.
So that's what you were doing in Cash's clothes last night, Dahl said.
He said it just like he was reading it out in the paper. Like he never give a darn himself one way or the other.
Jewel had come back now, standing there, looking at Ants with them marble eyes of his'n.
Cash aimed to buy that talking machine from Surratt with that money, Dahl said.
Ant stood there, mumbling his mouth. Jewel watched him. He ain't never blinked yet.
But that's just $8 more, Dahl said, in that voice like he was just listening and never give a darn himself. That still won't buy a team.
Ants looked at Jewel quick, kind of sliding his eyes that way. Then he looked down again.
God knows if there were e'er man, he says.
Still, they didn't say nothing. They just watched him, waiting, and him sliding his eyes toward their feet and up their legs, but no higher.
And the horse, he says.
What horse? Jewel said.
Ants just stood there.
I'd be darned. If a man can't keep the upper hand of his sons, he ought to run them away from home, no matter how big they are.
And if he can't do that, I'd be darned if he oughtn't to leave himself.
I'd be darned if I wouldn't.
You mean you tried to swap my horse? Jewel says.
Ant stands there, dangle-armed.
For 15 years I ain't had a tooth in my head, he says. God knows it. He knows in 15 years I ain't et the vittles he aimed for man to eat to keep his strength up. And me saving a nickel here and a nickel there so my family wouldn't suffer it, to buy them teeth so I could eat God's appointed food. I give that money. I thought that if I could do without eating, my sons could do without riding. God knows I did.
Jules stands with his hands on his hips, looking at ants. Then he looks away. He looked out across the field, his face still as a rock, like it was somebody else talking about somebody else's horse and him not even listening. Then he spit, slow, and said, "Hell." And he turned and went on to the gate and unhitched the horse and got on it. It was moving when he come into the saddle. And by the time he was on it, they was tearing down the road like the law might have been behind them. They went out of sight that way, the two of them looking like some kind of a spotted cyclone. "Well," I says, "you take my team," I said. But he wouldn't do it. And they wouldn't even stay. And that boy chasing them buzzards all day in the hot sun until he was nigh as crazy as the rest of them. "Leave Cash here anyway," I said. But they wouldn't do that. They made a pallet for him with quilts on top of the coffin and laid him on it and set his tools by him. And we put my team in and hauled the wagon about a mile down the road. "If we'll bother you here," Aunt says, "just say so." "Sure," I said. "It'll be fine here. Safe, too. Now let's go back and eat supper." "I thank you," Aunt said. "We got a little something in the basket. We can make out." "Where'd you get it?" I said. "We brought it from home." "But it'll be stale now," I said. "Come and get some hot vittles." But they wouldn't come. "I reckon we can make out," Aunt said. So I went home and ate and taken a basket back to them and tried again to make them come back to the house. "I thank you," he said. "I reckon we can make out." So I left them there, squatting around a little fire waiting. God knows what for. I come on home. I kept thinking about them there, and about that fellow tearing away on that horse. And that would be the last they would see of him. And I'd be darned if I could blame him. Not for wanting to not give up his horse, but for getting shut of such a darned fool as Ants. Or that's what I thought then. Because be it darn if there ain't something about a darn fella like Ants that seems to make a man have to help him, even when he knows he'll be wanting to kick himself next minute. Because about an hour after breakfast next morning, Eustace Grimm that works Snope's place come up with a span of mules, hunting Ants. "I thought him and Ants never traded," I said.
"Sure," Eustace said. "All they liked was the horse. Like I said to Mr. Snopes, he was letting this team go for $50, because if his Uncle Flem had a just kept them Texas horses when he owned them, Ants wouldn't have never..."
"The horse?" I said.
"Ants's boy taken that horse and cleared out last night. Probably halfway to Texas by now, and Ants..." "I didn't know who brung it," Eustace said. "I never see them. I just found the horse in the barn this morning when I went to feed, and I told Mr. Snopes, and he said to bring the team on over here."
"Well, that'll be the last they'll ever see of him now, sure enough. Come Christmas time, they'll maybe get a postal card from him in Texas, I reckon. And if it hadn't have been Jewel, I reckoned it'd have been me. I owe him that much myself. I be darned if Ants don't conjure a man some way. I be darned if he ain't a sight."
Vardaman. Now there are seven of them in little tall black circles. "Look, Dar," I say. "See?" He looks up. We watch them in little tall black circles of not moving. "Yesterday there were just four," I say. There were more than four on the barn. "Do you know what I would do if he tries to light on the wagon again?" I say. "What would you do?" Dahl says. "I wouldn't let him light on her," I say. "I wouldn't let him light on Cash either." "Cash is sick. He is sick on the box. But my mother is a fish." "We got to get some medicine in Motson," Pa says. "I reckon we'll just have to." "How do you feel, Cash?" Dahl says. "It don't bother none," Cash says. "Do you want it propped a little higher?" Dahl says. "Cash has a broken leg. He has had two broken legs. He lies on the box with a quilt rolled under his head and a piece of wood under his knee." "I reckon we ought to left him at Armstead's," Pa says. "I haven't got a broken leg, and Pa hasn't, and Darl hasn't, and..." "It's just the bumps," Cash says. "It kind of grinds together a little on a bump. It don't bother none." "Jewel has gone away. He and his horse went away one supper time." "It's because she wouldn't have us beholden," Pa says. "'Fore God, I do the best that e'er man." "Is it because Jewel's mother is a horse, Dahl?" I said. "Maybe I can draw the ropes a little tighter," Dahl says. "That's why Jewel and I were both in the shed, and she was in the wagon, because the horse lives in the barn, and I had to keep on running the buzzard away from." "If you just would," Cash says. "And Dewey Dell hasn't got a broken leg, and I haven't. Cash is my brother." We stop. When Dahl loosens the rope, Cash begins to sweat again. His teeth look out. "Hurt?" Dahl says. "I reckon you better put it back," Cash says. Dahl puts the rope back, pulling hard. Cash's teeth look out. "Hurt?" Dahl says. "It don't bother none," Cash says. "Do you want Pa to drive slower?" Dahl says. "No," Cash says. "Ain't no time to hang back. It don't bother none." "We'll have to get some medicine at Motson," Pa says. "I reckon we'll have to." "Tell him to go on," Cash says. We go on. Dewey Dell leans back and wipes Cash's face. "Cash is my brother." "But Jewel's mother is a horse. My mother is a fish. Dahl says that when we come to the water again, I might see her. And Dewey Dell said, she's in the box. How could she have got out?" "She got out through the holes I bored. Into the water," I said, "and when we come to the water again, I am going to see her. My mother is not in the box. My mother does not smell like that. My mother is a fish." "Those cakes will be in fine shape by the time we get to Jefferson," Dahl says. Dewey Dell does not look around. "You better try to sell them in Motson," Dahl says. "When will we get to Motson, Dahl?" I say. "Tomorrow," Dahl says. "If this team don't rack to pieces, Snopes must have fed them on sawdust." "Why did he feed them on sawdust, Dahl?" I say. "Look," Dahl says. "See? Now there are nine of them, tall in little tall black circles. When we come to the foot of the hill, Pa stops and Dahl and Dewey Dell and I get out. Cash can't walk because he has a broken leg." "Come up, mules," Pa says. The mules walk hard. The wagon creaks. Darl and Dewey Dell and I walk behind the wagon up the hill. When we come to the top of the hill, Pa stops and we get back into the wagon. Now there are 10 of them, tall in little tall black circles on the sky.
Mosley. I happened to look up and saw outside the window, looking in. Not close to the glass and not looking at anything in particular. Just standing there with her head turned this way and her eyes full on me and kind of blank, too. Like she was waiting for a sign. When I looked up again, she was moving toward the door. She kind of bumbled at the screen door a minute, like they do, and came in. She had on a stiff brim straw hat sitting on the top of her head, and she was carrying a package wrapped in newspaper. I thought that she had a quarter or a dollar at the most, and that after she stood around a while, she'd maybe buy a cheap comb or a bottle of nigger toilet water, so I never disturbed her for a minute or so except to notice that she was pretty in a kind of sullen, awkward way, and that she looked a sight better in her gingham dress and her own complexion than she would after she bought whatever she would finally decide on, or tell that she wanted. I knew that she had already decided before she came in. But you have to let them take their time. So I went on with what I was doing, figuring to let Albert wait on her when he caught up at the fountain, when he came back to me. "That woman," he said, "you better see what she wants." "What does she want?" I said. "I don't know. I can't get anything out of her. You better wait on her." So I went around the counter. I saw that she was barefooted, standing with her feet flat and easy on the floor, like she was used to it. She was looking at me hard, holding the package. I saw she had about as black a pair of eyes as ever I saw, and she was a stranger. I never remembered seeing her in Motson before. "What can I do for you?" I said. Still, she didn't say anything. She stared at me without winking. Then she looked back at the folks at the fountain. Then she looked past me, toward the back of the store. "Do you want to look at some toilet things?" I said. "Or is it medicine you want?" "That's it," she said. She looked quick back at the fountain again. So I thought maybe her ma or somebody had sent her in for some of this female dope and she was ashamed to ask for it. I knew she couldn't have a complexion like hers and use it herself, let alone not being much more than old enough to barely know what it was for. It's a shame, the way they poison themselves with it. But a man's got to stock it or go out of business in this country. "Oh," I said, "what do you use?" "We have..." She looked at me again, almost like she had said hush, and looked toward the back of the store again. "I'd liefer go back there," she said. "All right," I said. "You have to humor them. You save time by it." I followed her to the back. She put her hand on the gate. "There's nothing back there but the prescription case," I said. "What do you want?" She stopped and looked at me. It was like she had taken some kind of a lid off her face, her eyes. It was her eyes, kind of dumb and hopeful and sullenly willing to be disappointed all at the same time. But she was in trouble of some sort. I could see that. "What's your trouble?" I said. "Tell me what it is you want. I'm pretty busy." I wasn't meaning to hurry her, but a man just hasn't got the time they have out there. "It's the female trouble," she said. "Oh," I said, "is that all?" I thought maybe she was younger than she looked, and her first one had scared her, or maybe one had been a little abnormal, as it will in young women. "Where's your ma?" I said. "Haven't you got one?"
"She's out yonder in the wagon," she said.
"Why not talk to her about it before you take any medicine?" I said. "Any woman would have told you about it." She looked at me, and I looked at her again and said, "How old are you?"
17, she said.
"Oh," I said. "I thought maybe you were..." She was watching me. But then in the eyes, all of them looked like they had no age and knew everything in the world anyhow. "Are you too regular or not regular enough?" She quit looking at me, but she didn't move.
"Yes," she said. "I reckon so. Yes."
"Well, which?" I said. "Don't you know?" "It's a crime and a shame. But after all, they'll buy it from somebody." She stood there, not looking at me. "You want something to stop it?" I said. "Is that it?"
"No,"
she said.
"That's it. It's already stopped."
"Well, what?" Her face was lowered a little still, like they do in all their dealings with a man so he don't ever know just where the lightning will strike next. "You're not married, are you?" I said.
"No."
"Oh," I said. "And how long has it been since it stopped? About 5 months, maybe?"
"It ain't been but 2, she said.